Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes.
Welcome to Court Appointed, two dudes' perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. I'm finally used to it now. It doesn't throw me off. An extra judge in there used to throw me off. Now it doesn't throw me off.
It still throws me off a little bit when somebody says, hello, Judge Meadows.
And you look over your shoulder?
Yeah.
Hey, well, who's a judge with my name?
I just kind of laugh it off because... I mean, yes, I am a judge, but that's not my full-time position. It's just kind of a thing. So it's more of a novelty type thing at this point. So maybe one day I'll be a full-time judge.
I play one on TV.
Well, maybe a little bit more than that. I was watching. There's a clip that was going around the internet, and I saw it on Twitter, where it was a Judge Judy clip. It's kind of interesting. I figured you'd probably like it.
Oh, I always like Judge Judy
clips. Where there was a dispute over a car contract.
Yeah.
And the gentleman... said that he had agreed to sell the car to this lady for $5,000, and she said, no, it wasn't $5,000. And he said, well, we had a contract, but unfortunately he had moved and he didn't have a copy of the contract. Uh-huh. He said, but I did. And Judge Judy said, well, I don't want to hear what evidence you don't have. I want to hear what evidence you do have. It was real short with him.
Right.
And he said, well, I have this. And he pulled out his cell phone and said, gave it to the bailiff and said, here, just hit play. And it was a video, and the guy was holding the phone, so it was facing himself, and he was reading the contract as the words of it. And he said, now I'm going to go ahead and sign it. And he signs it. And then you wait, and he says, and now she's going to sign it. And he flips the camera around, and it shows a video of her actually signing the contract. And Judge Judy just kind of stops and says, smart, and then looks over at her. So it was an actual video recording of someone signing a contract.
That could be, but with Photoshop capabilities the way they are these days.
This was a live video of her signing it. It was obviously her, and she was...
But you don't know that that's really what she's signing. I mean, it could and went to something else.
No. This was a seamless video.
Really?
It was obvious that this guy just had... I mean, it wasn't like some elaborate, you know...
Well, there are people with skills like that that could fool you, though.
There are. Yeah, but I tended to believe the veracity of this video over a $5,000 small claims car.
Well, could be. There's a lot of scammers, good scammers. They got Barbara from Shark Tank. She got scammed for almost $400,000.
Well, I would say that it would actually be harder to forge that video in that manner than it would be for him just to forge her signature and sign it.
Yeah, probably so.
Now, who got scammed?
Barbara on Shark Tank. Barbara Corcoran, I think her name is. She's one of the sharks on Shark Tank.
Sounds like she ended up being a guppy.
Oh, yeah, she got took. And they've traced it to a Chinese IP. So they don't think they're going to get the money back.
Mm.
But it was someone, all they did was change one letter in an email address that there was somebody working for her in Germany that was buying some property for her, and they wired them, said, send this money to this, and it was some scammer who had been hacked into their email system or something and knew what was going on and acted like they were the person there acting on her behalf in Germany and changed one letter in the email address. So when they wire transferred, it went to this other account.
Yeah, there's some very kind of clever people out there that try to do stuff like that to trick you. You have to be very careful. Whenever you read anything that seems maybe just a little bit out of the ordinary, you have to really be on guard.
You'd think a shark would have better safeguards in place. That's how they got to be a shark.
Well, maybe she stopped swimming for a minute and fell asleep.
Could be. Must have.
That's all my shark metaphors I have.
And one other thing while we're off topic anyway, or haven't started our topic.
Yeah, we're on topic as far as they know.
It's a follow-up to last week. We were talking about pardons.
Oh, yeah. So what do you, it's a update.
Update.
This just into the newsroom.
We have an update. We mentioned last week about the governor of Kentucky that pardoned some horrendous people as he was leaving after he didn't get reelected, and he pardoned a bunch of people, about 100 of them or
something.
Right,
he decided
like
to release a plague upon Kentucky.
Yeah, and I mean, there were murderers and child rapists and everything that were involved in it, and he let them out.
Yeah, and the thing is, too, these are all people that were convicted by a jury or entered a plea.
They were serving sentences.
Yes, these aren't people that, you know, well, maybe they didn't do it. No, we are pretty much sure they did it.
One of the guys that he pardoned, a guy, the governor's name was Matt Bevin, was Patrick Baker, and he had only served 2 years of a 19-year sentence for reckless homicide and robbery in the slaying of a Knox County man in front of his family. But they think the reason may be is Baker's brother held a campaign fundraiser for Matt Bevin in 2018. Then mysteriously, after that, his brother gets let out of prison.
I'm telling you, that stinks.
I know. So the Kentucky legislature is wanting to do something about that so that never happens again. One of the things they're putting safeguards in about before anybody can be released from jail early or pardoned or anything like that, the victims have to be notified.
Yeah.
And let them know that this person's there, and also give them a chance to testify or whatever if they're up for parole or something like that, that they can come in and give the reasons why they shouldn't be letting them out.
Yeah. Well, they do that here in West Virginia. The people who are the victims, they get to give impact statements to the parole board before someone makes parole.
Yeah, but this is for a pardon or right. something. They're wanting something in place for that.
Right, because that's just an executive decision. There's no kind of
oversight or anything. Yeah. And then they also are saying they're passing a law, and it looks like it's pretty much a bipartisan thing because it passed 33-4 in the Senate, that if you are, the pardons have to take place a month before an election, that the period from a month before an election until inauguration day, you cannot pass any pardons. And that way, what they're saying is the person that's in that position then is going to be responsible, because he's either going to hurt himself if he's running for re-election, or he's going to hurt his party if he turns all these people loose right before an election and say, look what this guy did.
Yeah.
So they're saying that once you're a lame duck, they don't want you to have that power anymore.
I think this guy wanted to hurt his party. I think this guy wanted to watch the world burn.
Well, this guy, he was a little bit out there. I don't know if you ever saw much of him on TV and the way he acted. He got into a real knockdown drag out with the teachers union there and everything, and said some very unkind words about teachers.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know, but I don't know how he expected to win re-election. He just merely tied himself to Trump and thought that would be good enough, and it wasn't.
Yep. Yeah. He freed Barabbas and put Jesus to death, and it didn't turn out well for him.
No. But anyway,
keeping the whole Easter theme.
So, but it was bad enough where the legislature in a bipartisan nature decided we got to put an end to this.
I do agree with that in principle, but I think the spirit of having the executive have the ability to do that is generally a good thing. I think we have to trust in the fact that the executives we appoint to these positions are probably shouldn't abuse those. And if they do, then shame on us, the voters, for electing them.
Yeah, that's true.
But I do like the idea of, if you are going to free somebody, maybe they can put a percentage in. If you're going to free somebody with a certain percentage of their sentence still remaining, mm-hmm. that you have to allow the victims to come face-to-face and sit down with you and explain to you how this has affected their life. Because I think if that governor had sat there and listened to the families of the person who was slain in front of their family, if he had to listen to them say how that's affected their life, and then he has to look them in the eye and say, well, here's why I'm going to free them. His brother gave me a fundraiser.
Yeah.
You know, you might not be as apt to do that, because, you know, you are a piece of dung, but maybe you're not that big of a piece of dung.
Well, and here's one of the other things is, you know, when we read in there about the presidential pardons, it said usually they want them to have served at least 5 years of their sentence
before
they pardoned them.
And that's before it comes before the pardon board, that it makes its way to the president. But the president, you know,
right, he can do whatever, but they said that was kind of like a it's frowned upon if you do it before then.
Yeah.
but this was 2 years of a 19-year sentence, and he let this guy out of prison.
Yeah.
You know, this is still a fresh act in their mind of
that
everything.
That fundraiser must have been a hell of a party.
I guess so. He must have got some good money off of it, but... I don't know.
So you had sent me an article. It was a recent Supreme Court decision, and it was a unanimous decision. And that got me thinking, I wonder how many unanimous decisions the Supreme Court has on a daily basis, or whenever they release opinions.
A session basis, huh?
Yeah. So do you think a unanimous decision is rare? What do you think?
Well, I would like to think that these guys all know the law and that they all would probably draw from the same things and should probably agree on more than they disagree. So I'd say probably, I would think about 60 or 70% should be unanimous.
Well, I think we're going to fall a little short of that percentage, but yeah. I think in spirit, it's pretty much there. So according to the Supreme Court database, which is an independent website, since 2000, and this they had only looked up through 2018 or 2019, so it's not through like the most recent opinions, mm-hmm. but a unanimous decision has been the most likely outcome of any other result.
Hmm.
36% of all 36% of all decisions are unanimous.
Wow.
7-2 or 8-1, which are pretty resounding.
Pretty close, yeah.
Make up 15%. And 5-4, which are the kind of split decisions, only make up 19%. Hmm. So, yeah, they actually do tend to agree most
more
of the
than they disagree.
Yeah. Hmm. Which I think that is a really good thing. Like you said, I think that shows that these are people who have studied the law and understand it and can come to an agreement and not necessarily be held together by party lines or anything like that. It's nonpartisan. So.
It should be. They're supposed to be.
Yeah. And also, Justice Roberts, when he became the Supreme Court Justice, he was talking about how, or the Chief Justice rather, he was talking about how he wanted to have them sit and talk and discuss things and rationalize things and try to talk about the ins and the outs of the law and how it applies.
Like John Marshall used to do, right? When he remember they'd all sit and eat dinner together and discuss the things.
So that's what he wanted to do, and I think that's a, you know, a great idea. So I think he's been a pretty good Chief Justice in my opinion.
Well, I think that he's been doing all that he can do to try to make things fair.
Yeah.
I don't think he doesn't want to be the chief of a court that is found to be leaning one way blatantly or anything like that.
Right.
And I think that's important. I think if you look at it from a legacy standpoint, I would rather be thought of as a thoughtful and fair judge rather than I serve the purpose of the party that appointed me.
I towed the party line.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what kind of honor is that?
Yeah. Not your honor, Your Honor.
No.
So the case you had sent me was Rodriguez v. Federal Deposit Insurance Company, FDIC. So you've probably seen those signs on banks.
Right.
Before, banks always say FDI insured.
Right.
And the FDIC is, I'm just going to get a little background here so you kind of understand. The FDIC is an independent agency of the United States government that protects you against the loss of your insured deposits if it is an FDI insured bank or savings association and it goes under. FDIC insurance is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So the government's putting their name on it and standing behind it. And the insurance covers depositors of failed banks dollar for dollar, principal plus any interest accrued or due to the depositor through the date of the default, up to at least $250,000. So, for example, if you have a CD account in your name alone with a principal balance of $195,000 and $3,000 in accrued interest, the full $198,000 would be insured since the principal plus interest did not exceed $250,000. So, it goes all the way up to that. So that's what that is. So it's kind of a good thing. It makes you feel comfortable.
It's a very good thing. You know what brought that about? I'm drawing on the recesses of my brain, but you know what brought the FDIC about?
What's that?
The Depression.
When all the
banks failed and people didn't get their money back.
Well,
so everybody lost faith in the banks. So then when things were recovering, the banks were having a hard time getting anybody to come put their money in the bank because they were afraid they wouldn't get it. So they were stuffing it in mattresses.
Right. People would take their money out of banks, too.
Yeah.
It was a run on the banks.
So that's what the government did to ensure trust in the banks and to guarantee that your money would be available because the strong banking system was essential to a growing economy.
So this case is kind of an interesting one, and Justice Neil Gorsuch stated it was a curious corner of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always, whenever you see a justice say something's a curious corner of the law, it tends to pique your interest.
Well, I'll tell you what caught my eye about it. This is why I sent it to you. When I read it, it's like, the name's not in the thing. It's whatever, Rodriguez v. whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But they talk about the Bob Richards rule.
Yeah.
It's Bob Richards this, and nobody stood up for Bob Richards, and Bob Richards was the ruling thing. It's like, who the hell is Bob Richards? And it sounded so, it's so bizarre.
What about Bob?
Yeah. It was so, Bob Richards. Everybody talking about, who is this guy, Bob Richards? And then they were disappointed when nobody came and stood up for Bob.
Well, we're going to get into how Bob Richards plays a role in that case. But I think first we have a motion before the court today.
Why, yes, if it please your judgeship, we'd like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
All right. Who do we have first on the docket today?
We have on the docket today the fine people of Care Of.
Care Of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals with a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term.
Set a resolution you'll actually keep. Make 2020 the year to prioritize you and commit to staying on top of your health.
Instead of that laundry list of resolutions you don't end up sticking with, Care Of can make taking your vitamins and supporting your health goals attainable.
Care Of's quiz helps you find the vitamins and powders that will support your specific health goals this year, like improving your fitness routine or managing stress.
Care Of is focused on the quality, science, and research that goes into each of their products and recommendations.
The individual eco-friendly packs are made of compostable films, and there's tons of info on how to compost them on Care Of's site.
You can take a short online quiz and answer some questions about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle, and Care Of will recommend a list of vitamins and supplements specifically for your health needs and goals.
Yeah, the quiz was pretty cool.
It is really cool.
Went through there and answered the questions, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen at the end, but then it's like, okay, your package is on the way, and it showed up with my name on it.
That's right.
Individual daily dosages.
That's right. It makes it super simple. It's got instructions that even we can follow.
That's right. Even a dude could follow.
So, right now, there's a special offer for court-appointed listeners. For 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the code court50.
So that's 50% off on your first Care Of order. Go to takecareof.com and enter the code court50 to claim your 50% off for your first order. Because Tommy and Mike want you to be healthy in the new year.
Hear, hear. So, to get back to our friend Bob Richards and who he is.
Where the hell did Bob Richards come from?
Well, the case at hand, the Rodriguez case, which let's go ahead and talk about that first. That stems from a dispute between two affiliated corporations about the allocation of their $4 million return on consolidated taxes. But the question before the court wasn't who gets the money. This actually dealt with what you said, the Bob Richards rule, which, strangely enough, only some circuits follow it, and it wasn't actually written into any kind of congressionally approved statute. This was essentially a Supreme Court common law type rule that was promulgated by the Supreme Court at one point.
Yeah, they kind of accepted it, but nobody ever made it whatever you call that
codified law.
Yeah, that you rule by, that you quote this. If you were before the Supreme Court, you quote this and this will get you by.
So the Bob Richards rule determines how a consolidated corporate tax refund is distributed in bankruptcy cases. So to give you a bit of background about the Bob Richards, this will explain what we're talking about a little bit. Bob Richards was a Chrysler Plymouth dealership that went bankrupt. Bob Richards Chrysler was a wholly owned subsidiary of Western Dealer Management, Inc., and I'm just going to start saying WDM because it's getting a little too wordy.
Weapons of Destruction Mass.
That's going to be stuck in my head now. WDM was also an unsecured of Bob Richards. So the difference being, talking about secured versus unsecured, credit card debt is generally unsecured. So if you default on the credit card, the bank that issues a card.
There's no collateral.
They don't have any recourse.
Yeah.
Whereas a car loan or a mortgage, something like that, would be secured. Or if you buy something and secure another piece of property or something you own to get that line of credit, they can be secured.
Right.
So the WDM was unsecured creditor of Bob Richards, and Bob Richards owed WDM about $45,000 when they filed for bankruptcy. And WDM was one of their creditors in that bankruptcy proceeding. So WDM got permission and filed a consolidated tax return for WDM, Bob Richards, and another wholly owned corporation of WDM using that little IRS provision where they can file consolidated corporate tax returns,
right?
Which is
what a lot of them do rather than file one for each of them. It just kind of streamlines the entire process. It makes more sense. And because they were able to file this consolidated one, they were able to secure a refund of $10,000. So they got a tax refund of $10,000. But here's the catch. That entire $10,000 refund was basically just because of Bob Richards, the now bankrupt company.
And all the money they lost.
Right. So they were the reason why they got that money back. So, right.
But WDM said, we're out $45,000. So we're going to consolidate these income tax returns so that we get some money back, and we're going to use that money to apply towards what you owe us.
Right, because they were otherwise an unsecured
creditor. So they weren't going to get any of it.
Yeah. And so, of course, as happens in situations like this, when you're fighting over $10,000, oddly enough, there was a court case, and it made its way to the Supreme Court, and that was the Bob Richards case. And that made its way to the Supreme Court in the, it's called Inri Bob Richards Chrysler Plymouth Corp. case. And
for short, the Bob Richards case.
That's right. So that was a Ninth Circuit ruling, and the Ninth Circuit interpreted it one way, and then the Tenth Circuit interpreted it a different way. So the Ninth Circuit ruled that absent an explicit agreement otherwise, when a parent corporation gets a refund on behalf of its various subsidiaries, the money presumptively belongs to the company whose losses gave rise to it. So the refund, the Ninth Circuit held, the refund had to be paid to the bankruptcy trustee, which presumptively was to be paid out to the various creditors of Bob Richards as the trustee saw appropriate. So WDM may have gotten some of that. They may not have. It just depends on however the trustee divvied it up through the bankruptcy. So that was the ruling that came out, and that was kind of a way that the Ninth Circuit interpreted that, but it wasn't any kind of law or rule or anything like that. They just felt, and I have to agree, if you're looking at this in an equitable type situation, that seems pretty equitable to me.
Well, yeah, in a way. In another way, though, I could argue that the other guy, if you owed him $45,000, that he deserved to get the money back as part of that because he wasn't going to get all of it.
But I think this area could be ripe for abuse, though, because they were a wholly owned subsidiary of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
they're kind of paying themselves in a certain way of looking at it.
That's true.
So,
and they didn't have they should have put a written agreement in place.
Well, and
somebody had to come up with the idea, you know?
Yeah, and that's what we were talking about, the tax allocation agreements. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on, but there wasn't any kind of written agreement about how taxes were to be split.
I think they just assumed that the other group knew that's why they were doing that.
Yeah.
Look, we're going to consolidate these so that your loss will generate a return, and we'll use that to offset some of the losses. And the guy goes, okay.
You're assuming the trustee knew that was what was going to happen.
Well, I don't know about the trustee, but at least the Bob Richards representatives.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the WMD people thought that's why they understood why they were doing that.
Yeah, I think maybe the other side didn't. The bankruptcy trustee probably didn't realize that they were going to get a refund solely based upon Bob Richards' losses at the Chrysler Plymouth dealership.
Right. And see, the thing is if he had been able to file his own, he probably would have gotten an even bigger return because he went bankrupt, so he obviously didn't make any money. And if he just based it on his own income, because if WMD made money, and then it offset it with his losses.
Yeah.
Then they got $10,000 back. Maybe if he'd filed his own, maybe he'd got $40,000 back.
Possibly, but there might have been more.
But then WMD thought, well, we're not going to be able to get that. That's theirs.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a sticky wicket.
It's a sticky wicket. So the Rodriguez case came before the Tenth Circuit of Appeals, and the Tenth Circuit applied the Bob Richards rule in a dispute with the FDIC, as we said. And the FDIC, who was a receiver for a bank, so the bank, basically the bank's parent corporation and trustee, they were wanting to apply kind of a similar analysis to that because they had a subrogation interest. So they were saying, hey, we should get that tax back because of the Bob Richards rule. Mm-hmm. The FDIC was trying to say, like, hey, we're a governmental entity. We should get that money too.
Right.
And because there was kind of a split that between the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to review that recently, and that's the opinion that just came out, I think it was yesterday or the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So they had oral arguments in December, and this is the strange thing. At oral arguments, so at the Tenth Circuit, the FDIC was arguing for it, But then during our oral arguments before the Supreme Court, Bob Richards had no advocates.
No one stood up for Bob Richards.
No one stood up for the Bob Richards rule.
They failed to make that argument that should apply.
So theoretically, the FDIC wanted that rule affirmed, and they really wanted because they would have benefited from it. Mm-hmm. But evidently, they had kind of decided, you know what, maybe we actually don't want this rule in place.
I mean, maybe it might have been to their advantage in that particular case, but maybe it would have hurt them in other cases.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense.
And they decided it wasn't in their best interest to argue for it, so they just let it go. And Bob Richards no longer exists now.
So you have a Supreme Court argument where there's only one side presenting arguments. Yeah. So I think that would have been a good one for me to argue.
Yeah, if you had no one opposing you.
Yeah.
All right, we'll hear arguments for the defense.
Although I have had I have had the privilege of losing a hearing when there was no one else on the other side because the judge just didn't like what I had to say.
Well, that's not good. You should have just kept your mouth shut and just hoped that just by showing up, is just like I said on that Holiday Inn sign that I saw one time.
Yeah, well,
90% of success is just showing up.
I know I'm not the only person that's happened to. So sometimes even if you're there by yourself, the law's just not on your side.
I remember the girls, Sydney and Taylor, were little, and we saw that on that Holiday Inn sign going on vacation somewhere. I said, you see that, girls? It's words to live by. 90% of success is just showing up. And Sydney looked at me, she said, I hope that's not true, Dad.
So evidently it was kind of a funny argument because the justices were kind of laughing that no one was there to argue for poor old Bob Richards.
Yeah, poor old Bob Richards just got flushed down the toilet in that argument. Now he doesn't even have any standing because I don't even think they would accept an argument for Bob Richards anymore.
They even said that no friend of the court was appointed to stand up for the sad, abandoned position.
Yeah, it had a court-appointed lawyer, huh?
Yeah.
To represent Bob Richards.
The counsel, though, for Rodriguez argued that the case had massive economic implications for businesses and creditors, which they are probably correct about that.
True.
And he urged the justices to clear up confusion about Bob Richards, which would allow financial advisors to provide clear guidance nationwide about applicable laws. So let's clear up any kind of confusion about this because we just don't need to have this rule. And talking about these tax allocation agreements and how far-reaching this Bob Richards rule was, a lot of larger corporations have tax allocations agreements. So if they're all linked together and they're filing one tax return, they have an agreement in place that says, okay, here's how we're going to allocate any kind of tax return we get. And they explicitly state how the different taxes are to be divided.
We're going to take it all.
Yeah. So in the Bob Richards case, it came about because there was no allocation agreement. Mm-hmm. So the Bob Richards rule has become so pervasive that in these tax allocation agreements that they actually do to this day, the parties would typically disclaim the Bob Richards rule specifically and state expressly that the result of the tax return they wanted, what they wanted to have happen. So this case actually finds its way into all these different documents among all these different corporations because of this one case.
But they're saying that they won't impose the Bob Richards ruling. Is that what you're saying? That they have to say, I'm not going to.
Yeah, well, they basically state that they don't want it to be split the way that it was in Bob Richards.
Yeah.
Now, they don't just say, we're not doing Bob Richards. I mean, they're much more articulate than that.
Yeah.
But that's the essence of what they're saying.
Bob don't live here.
Yeah. What about Bob? Nope, not about Bob.
That was a movie, What About Bob, wasn't it? That one with Bill Murray.
So, oh yeah, that's why I keep saying that.
Yeah,
I love that movie. So the interesting thing is that before the FDIC or before the Tenth Circuit, the FDIC had argued that Bob Richards' rule should be expanded and applied to the subrogation interest of the FDIC, and the Tenth Circuit actually agreed about that. So, you know, on one hand, before the Tenth Circuit, the FDIC is arguing one thing, and then they get to the Supreme Court and say, well, maybe not. So they changed their mind.
Something happened there that made them change their position on that. I don't know what it was, but maybe they had some other pending litigation they stood to lose more on or something.
Yeah. So. Or maybe they got a little note saying, hey, the court's conservative now and you're going to lose this.
Well, but this is something that made it into common law that was cited and practiced, but yet it didn't stand up once it reached the Supreme Court, and I guess it can't really be cited again now or anything.
Well, there was some disparity because the Sixth Circuit did not follow the Bob Richards rule. The Sixth Circuit stated that federal common law constitutes an unusual exercise of lawmaking, which should be indulged only when there is a significant conflict between some federal policy or interest and the use of state law, essentially stating that the federal government needs to stay in its lane when it comes to these kinds of issues, at least the federal judiciary.
And the federal government doesn't have an interest in who gets the tax return. Is that what they're saying?
They don't, because that is, they do have an interest in it.
Well, they have to return it.
But their jurisdiction is with the bankruptcy itself, not with the dispute about the property. Congress, and the Sixth Circuit actually went on to address this a little bit more. It said, Congress has generally left the determination of property rights in the assets of bankrupt estates to state law. So if you're going to argue about who owns assets in a bankruptcy, the state law is going to determine that, not the bankruptcy court. So
and Bob Richards was more of a federal law because it was made by the Ninth Circuit Court.
Right. Essentially, what the federal government was doing was saying who owns property that is in dispute between these different corporations. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like the federal government was stepping in on the state court's jurisdiction over who owns something. So. And as I said, there is conservatism in the court. And when I say conservatism, I'm not talking about like
the way they dress,
the way they dress or or their positions on faith and things like that. I'm talking mm-hmm. about they're taking a narrow view, a very narrow view and approach to what the federal government can do. You know, going back to the age-old argument of
States' rights
versus federal rights, mm-hmm. they're leaning more towards states' rights at this mm-hmm. point, because that's more of a conservative type view. So, and essentially judicial lawmaking, aka federal common law, as you said, they said that it should play a modest role. If there's something missing in the tax code or somewhere else, it is not up to the court to fill in the gaps. That's kind of the essence of what they're saying, is that, you know, this is something that we don't need to get in there, because there's already a way to resolve this.
So they're saying they filed their federal tax return. They chose to do it consolidated. We, as the federal government, sent them their check back just to the place where they, you know, where they filled out their form. Mm-hmm. So we're done with it after that.
Yeah.
You all have a dispute. Talk to your governor.
Yeah. There's a bankruptcy, and you all figure, once you figure out who owns it, then you go to the bankruptcy trustee with it then. You know, until then, don't come to the federal court trying to figure this out. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And so the Bob Richards rule is no more. It's going to be a footnote in history. And
passing of poor Bob.
That's right.
Poor Bob Richards.
So I think what this really, what they're doing is they're talking to the circuit courts as well, is urging federal courts to show judicial restraint and not to use the bench to make new law.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of it is a good idea, and I think that was probably the fair outcome. I just don't think that's the right way they went about it.
Yeah.
In my mind.
They should have argued it anyway.
What's that?
The Bob Richards rule. They didn't even argue it. They just gave it up.
They did. They gave up on Bob.
Yeah.
Well, maybe Bob quit on them. I don't know.
Could you imagine if you were Bob Richards and it's like, I got a law named after me. You do? Yeah, I named it just because of me. Well, what'd you do? I went bankrupt. They named a law after me because I went bankrupt.
I'd rather not talk about it. It was a dark time. It was back in the 70s, too. I mean, back then, Chrysler and Plymouth was doing good, I thought.
Well, I think that was around the time when Chrysler went under, because they were making all those great big gas-guzzling boats.
Oh.
And then they switched over to the K cars after that, because a bunch of the Chrysler dealerships did poorly.
Yeah, I think
that was in the 70s. That was when the gas lines got so long and all that kind of stuff went on with the gas shortages.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Because I'm thinking more of their like kind of iconic muscle cars were probably more like late 60s, early 70s. This was 76, 77 or something
like
that. Yeah,
something like that. That's at the height of the gas shortage. And I think that's when Chrysler switched. That's when Lee Iacocca got in there and started able to make the K cars.
That's right, the iconic K cars.
Yeah, it all fell apart, but they had good gas mileage.
So since we're talking about Chrysler's in Plymouth, why don't you tell us which Chrysler Plymouth you owned? I'm sure you had like some sort of old classic Chrysler Plymouth car.
Well, I owned an old...
this is the part of the time where Tommy's history.
What was it, a 70 or a 72 Plymouth Fury?
Ah.
The thing was big and long with the wings in the back, and it was blue with a vinyl top, and I was driving to work one morning over in Ashland, and the damn engine blew up.
Really?
Yeah, it blew up and the hood blew off and everything else. Well, I think it just made the hood pop, but the wind, since I was on the interstate, caught the rest of it and took it off.
Did you have oil in it?
I don't know. That's debatable. I know a lot of smoke came out. Might not have had the oil changed. I was still a young driver at that point.
Yeah, not as quite as responsible.
No, not as much at checking oil. You know, Dad usually took care of that stuff, but I wasn't living with Dad anymore. So,
yeah.
So that may have had something to do with it. But I remember I had to walk down over the hill and find a payphone and call Dad, say, "Hey, I'm stuck on the interstate."
So what were Dan Smurl's words of wisdom about that?
Did you check the oil?
My exact.
See, I've used that now too. Dads know to say that.
Yeah.
Kids don't know to say that. Did you check the oil? They don't know what that means.
Oh yeah, I have learned that as well, because I have two boys that are driving cars around,
and they don't check the oil. I guarantee you.
No, they don't even change it.
No.
I got to make sure they got their inspection stickers on there and all that stuff.
That's right.
It's like owning multiple cars that you have to take care of.
Oh, I know. I had daughters and a wife, and if I didn't take care of getting stickers for the license plate and inspections done and pay the taxes and all that stuff, none of the cars would be drivable.
I feel kind of like Bob Richards, owning a car dealership.
That's right, and I'm bankrupt.
Bankrupt on time.
Bankrupt on morals.
Well, no, I feel like I have morals. I mean, come on now. I am a part-time judge.
Well, that's true, but you're at me the other part of the time, you're a lawyer.
I saw one of my friends who I hadn't seen since I took that position. He said, "Hey, congratulations on the new prosecutor position." I said, "I'm not a prosecutor, I'm a judge." And he just kind of looked at me. I said, "Oh, I get it." He's making a joke that, I'm a... always going to side with the prosecution on the cases. Like, okay, I get it.
I would rather be thought of, if I'm the judge, that I'm also the executioner.
Well, yeah, the judge and the executioner.
Yeah.
The hanging judge.
Yeah. But it was just a parking ticket. I don't care. You'll never do it again.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
So Legal Breeze is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal terms and questions we talked about. And I got a couple doozies for you today.
Bob Richards.
No, Bob Richards, he's gone. He's not.
He's the answer we're looking for.
No, he's not. So when we're talking about creditors, what is the difference between secured and unsecured?
Well, secured would be like your car loan or your mortgage. It's secured by something that is tangible they can take from you if you don't pay your bill. Unsecured is like a credit card. If you run up a credit card, there's nothing they can come take from you. They can sue you or they can garnish your wages, but they can't take anything from you because it's unsecured.
And the other thing too is you can secure things, not just what you're paying for. So a car loan is generally secured with that car.
Right.
So in corporations like this, they're a bit more sophisticated. They might secure like earnings for a different year or something like that. It might be tied to a loan or something like that. So it can be different things that are secured, not just what it is that you're buying with it.
Or your firstborn or something like that.
That's frowned upon. It is.
No child exchange for collateral.
No. What is a tax allocation agreement?
A tax allocation agreement would be one that says, when we file this return, the money that comes back is going to be split in the aforementioned manner. And it will outline who gets what.
Yes, aforementioned. And that is when you have different corporations that are wholly owned together and linked together. It is a IRS provision which allows them to file a single tax return rather than multiple tax returns. So it streamlines the process.
That way, if one group makes money, another group loses money, then you can kind of balance it out and not have to pay a bunch of taxes on the one that makes it.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of employed that when I was self-employed with my own law practice. I kind of employed that with my spouse.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I was like, it was easier just to not pay as many taxes for myself, but then the spouse who had a job had her taxes taken out. So it was just kind of like, it was a wash. So it was almost like our own little tax allocation agreement.
Okay. As long as everybody's in agreement, it's okay.
There was an agreement.
Just remember Bob.
There was an agreement.
Don't leave Bob out.
There was an agreement until there wasn't.
Then there was an agreement to split everything.
Yeah. Then there was a complete allocation agreement.
A final liquidation. Everything must go.
Bye, bye, bye.
It's a fire sale.
This Sunday.
Bye, Felicia.
Okay, what is subrogation?
Subrogation? It sounds like where somebody makes you a subordinate. You have to bow down to them and do whatever they say.
Well, subrogation is when, and this usually arises in the insurance world, whenever there is like a claim paid. So say if you were in a car accident and you use your health insurance to accrue to get medical help, benefits, and it's say they paid $20,000 to make you Tommy again,
mm-hmm.
which is quite a bargain.
That's scary.
And you sue the person who hit you, and you get $50,000 as a settlement from them. Well, your insurance company has a subrogation lien against whatever you recover to pay.
They want their $20,000.
They want their $20,000 back. So that's what subrogation is essentially.
So just sue for the difference of what your insurance paid and what the other person gives you.
Well,
that way you don't have to give the insurance any.
No, because then they'll want that.
They want that?
Yeah. They're going to get it one way or the other.
I'll tell them, file your own lawsuit. I'm not looking out for you. I didn't take you to raise.
And
check your own oil.
That's what happened in the Rodriguez case with the FDIC. They felt they had a subrogation interest, and that's how this Rodriguez case kind of made its way to the court. So, and the last one, judicial restraint.
Judicial restraint.
You can have fun with this one, I'm sure.
Well, that's the judges restraining from making rulings that they feel are outside of what they should do, like the federal government overstepping state law.
Do you think if you were a judge, you could exercise judicial restraint?
No.
I agree.
I'd be banging the gavel and hanging them high. That would be my job. Well, you don't hang people on the Supreme Court. Well, we do now. We're in that business. Don't come before me again. But I'm the lawyer. I don't care. We're going to hang you too, just for representing this guy.
We're in that business, and brother, business is a booming. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is drug advertising. I don't like drug advertising. I don't understand the reason for it. I don't think people should be persuaded by a commercial to go ask for a drug from their doctor. I want my doctor to diagnose me and be aware of the best way to treat my problem and then prescribe that. Other than name brand or generic, I don't want to enter into the drug prescribing business. Mostly because I didn't go to med school and I am not a doctor. I would like to think that my doctors stay up to date on drugs and what they do and which ones are best under what circumstances. In this day and age of opioid addiction, you might suggest a Tylenol 3 instead of OxyContin. I know I did after my knee replacements. Did it work as well? I don't know. I lived, but I didn't want to take any chances. Whenever drugs are advertised, the final part of the commercial is usually all of the cautions about not being good if you have some other problems or all the possible side effects and all that stuff. That is a lot to take in and to understand, and to those not trained for these things, that's just not good. So you could go in seeking one of these TV drugs, and if the doctor isn't paying close attention, it could be a problem for you. I would like to think that doctors are all at the top of their game. But just as there are C students, I'm sure there are sea doctors that might not do their research. They would never prescribe this ad drug to you because they may not be aware of it. But if you adamantly ask for it and they are a sea doctor, well, be careful what you wish for. The other part I can't quit thinking about is the cost of these commercials. It has to be millions of dollars based on the frequency and time slots they are run in. The drug company then has to make that money back because they are in the business of making money. Therefore, that drug, which may cost 25 cents per pill to make, then is sold to us at $50 a pill because they have to get their advertising money back. I'm fully convinced that if you take the advertising costs out of drug cost, we would all be a lot better off. So for my part, I'm leaving the prescribing to my doctor. If he is going to give me something I suggest, then I am in trouble. I learned a while back that I am not the sharpest tool in the shed, and the last thing I need is to be at my own mercy in choosing drug intake. I know I wouldn't last very long if left to my own devices, so I'll take my chances on the doctors, who have gone to school and done residency and received further training and information. That's probably better than what I get from watching TV. Probably. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.